in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. This weekend is Chicago Comic Con weekend, and Word Balloon will be there and provide a lot of coverage in the days and weeks ahead. But for now, a great conversation with Marvel writer Paul Jenkins, who's back in the fold writing Son of Hulk. The Planet Scar Aftermath arc revolves around the journey of Hero Kala. This very sci-fi arc with a European feel is written by Paul and drawn by Andres Guinaldo. We'll also go in depth on many of Paul's special issues of Captain America Theater of War. That leads into a preview of some of Paul's new work for Marvel and a fascinating point of view discussion about character. From Paul's thoughts on characters like Thor, Loki, Iron Man, Captain America, and the Hulk, we'll discuss the century and how his beginnings came from a Superman Marvel Man template. Jenkins also will redress the flap he had with fans over Sally Floyd's tirade against Captain America from Civil War Frontline. And we'll get a fresh look at the business side of Paul's career as he discusses current and future plans. The conversation begins with a discussion of Paul's current arc for Planet Scar Aftermath in Son of Hulk. We'll start with Son of Hulk, the Planet Scar Aftermath, which began last week with issue 13. Now, this is interesting because you certainly had a run on the Hulk that everyone loves, but now you're back in the Hulk universe and dealing with a very different corner of the Hulk universe, and specifically following Hero Kala and his journey.
Well, when I did my first run on the Hulk, which now is around, I think, 2001 or 2000, something like that, at the time, I didn't really get a chance to tell some of the core Hulk stories. The reason I say that is the ones that are most memorable, there's a couple of issues that John Romita Jr. and I did together that I think most people see as being quite memorable,
mm-hmm.
To do with the Abomination. And in fact, I recently read an article that kind of listed it as one of the top 10 kind of Hulk must read before you see the movie kind of thing.
Cool.
But my job in those days at Marvel was in some part to help Marvel emerge from Chapter 11 bankruptcy. You have to put it in historical context. In those days, obviously, we'd come in with Marvel Knights. We'd done pretty well with Humans. We had a new character century that we pushed. I had come in and created a very quiet and small revolution with Spider-Man, which I actually started about 6 months before Joe Straczynski came onto the book.
Yes.
And people were very fond of that little run, you know.
Absolutely.
This is back in the day when I could do single issues, and really, in those days, before Joe was the editor-in-chief, and, you know, before Dan Buckley came around, before even Bill Gemmis had managed to really resurrect the company, you know, I could write single issues, and it was okay, because they really didn't know what to do with any of the titles. I think they were having a difficult time. We came in, we do a quiet little book. The next mandate I get is, okay, would you mind doing, you know, what do you want to do? You want to do the Hulk? That would be great. I believe at the time, John Byrne had been doing it. Joe Casey had done it, but the long run was done by Peter David, and he'd done it for so many years, and he'd done so many interesting things with it that everybody was having a hard time kind of recreating the Hulk or wrapping their heads around the years of continuity that Peter had created. But instead of writing stories about anger and core things that I think are interesting in the Hulk mythology, I ended up writing a story that kind of tied things together. It was, you know, here's where the Hulk's personalities lay, and here's what's been happening while Peter's been on the book, and here's what's been happening while John's been on the book. And let's try and, you know, mold these pieces together and come up with something interesting. And then I wrote a couple of interesting stories that I liked, and then I moved on, and Bruce Jones came in after me.
Yep.
But I feel kind of proud that my job was, and my mandate from the editors was, please provide us a platform that we can write interesting Hulk stories with, so that people will not necessarily complain that the new writer is not Peter David, because that was a big complaint that they were getting.
Sure.
You know, Peter's fans were very vocal about wanting him to stay on the book, and Marvel were kind of having a hard time. Anyway. Long-winded version of saying that when I came back around this time, I wanted to write about anger and big things and stuff smashing and, you know, large, interesting visual effects and stuff like that, and that's what this thing allows me to do.
Well, it's a cool space opera that, to me, feels very much like a heavy metal sci-fi story as much as it is part of this new status quo of the Hulk universe.
Yeah. I think you're right, actually. It does kind of give off that vibe, doesn't it? It's first of all, I think that one triumph in this book, before we go too much further, is that I was able to bring in, as an artist, I actually suggested Andres Ginaldo as the artist, and I think he really, really suits this concept.
Yes.
He is a European artist, so you mention that because his style in some ways is reminiscent of Bilal or you know, Mobius, you know, not necessarily the same, but just that attention to detail, a love of doing big planetary things, you know. So what we did was I got a call from Mark Panisha, who's the editor, and I have not done a monthly series for some time. Because I've been busy doing other things in film and television and video games. So most of my work over the last year or so has been single issues and smaller things. And he said, you know, I have this thing that I want to do, and it's Son of Hulk. Now, I'm pretty familiar with what Greg Pak's done because I get all the books from Marvel for a start. And
Okay. Second
of all, I worked on World War Hulk Frontlines.
Right.
And I love Greg's world. I think that's something you don't mess with. It's a really well-done version of how to do a space opera with the big King Hulk, and he became Mac Daddy, and that was really interesting. I was kind of somewhat, and there's the Hulk, right? The Hulk is back. You know, it's really cool. You get to do mad, big Hulk stories where he smashes stuff up, and he has this sense of pride and a sense of anger, and he's confused at times, and he's regal at times. It's very cool. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not sure that Son of Hulk is my kind of thing. And then Mark Panisha, the editor, mentioned something that I could do with the story, which sparked an idea in me, and I threw it back at him and said, well, how about if we did this? And within the space of literally 1 5-minute phone call, I was sold on the idea of coming back into that book, because the story that we devised together is a story that's worth telling.
Well, and it has expanded the Marvel cosmic world and universe in an interesting way, because I like the idea of Hulk stories in outer space, and I like him in his exotic locations, because, you know, after 40-plus years of Hulk Smash, it's nice to see, you know, them do different things. And they have in the past as well. But this really has kind of put new life and story ideas within, you know, the realm of telling Hulk stories. And then to even pay that much more attention to this interesting group of aliens that came out of Planet Hulk, I do look forward to their further interaction with the Marvel Universe. And maybe that's a presumption on my part, thinking that beyond the Galactus catalyst, that, you know, how much they are going to be dealing with other aspects of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, well, it's there's actually a logistical and practical point to this as well. I know this sounds funny. This might be a bit of insider trading knowledge that you guys don't get very often. When I did World War Hulk Frontlines, one of the things that I was actually kind of personally mortified about was I was given an editorial instruction that nobody is allowed to die. Now, to me, in that story, the Hulk coming back to Earth and getting ready to smash New York into little pieces was clearly the story of Hurricane Katrina. And
interesting.
I had set myself up to write this entire story about what it really must feel like to know this force is coming in. You know, human nobility can be seen, cowardice can be seen, all kinds of stuff that's actually going on behind the scenes. And then that really kind of cut me off at the knees. And I understand Marvel's reason, of course, for doing it, which is the Hulk can't be really a killer.
Yeah? Right, right.
But take him into an alien planet, yes, he can.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's not killing people. He's killing, like, crazy aliens, and those aliens are bad people. Like, it actually allows you to be liberated with the Hulk and to tell stories in a way. It's not all about death, of course. It's not really that important. But it's not that you need to kill people all the time. It's that if people need to die to make a point, and they can, and they can do it so in large numbers in a story like that, and we're able to kind of wrap our head around it, in a sense, without necessarily thinking that the Hulk is a killer, because it's a tough one for Marvel. They don't want him to be responsible for death. And when I took over the Hulk the first time, John Byrne had written a story in which he brings down a plane full of people, and the supposed thing was, well, he didn't mean to because he was mental, or someone, you know, made him do it. But the problem is, he still did it. And so it didn't it right, I think, with the people at Marvel, because their guy had literally, you know, murdered a jetliner full of people. So now, of course, I've got Hirakala, and Sakaar's just exploded, which is fun. So he has this band of ragtag remnants who've basically watched Galactus come in and kind of chew the planet up.
Yep.
And what I felt was really cool and intense is that, obviously, we review the materials that we had. We realize, oh, my word, this was always set up that Hirakala could be another Son of Hulk or the Son of Hulk. All of these prophecies kind of apply to Hirakala, not necessarily to Scar.
Yes.
And then Hirakala flies out, looks Galactus in the eye and says, I'm going to take you down to Galactus. And fandom collectively goes, woohoo, you go, boy.
Yes, this slave character suddenly has this very interesting spine and, yeah, is becoming the hero in this story. And I think that's very cool, man. How long are you on the run? I mean, is it for this arc alone, or are you going to... What's the plan?
It's for this arc alone.
Okay.
I have, you know, I know that Mark Panisci has come to me and already spoken about potentially moving on to another, and I wouldn't discount doing it. I'd like to see the reaction to the book and see that we are on the right path. But my plan was only ever to do the 5-issue series.
Okay.
And to bring this interesting kind of arc to its conclusion. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I won't do any more. It's just more like we really only talked about this one arc. I don't think we've ever particularly said that we had plans to do something else.
Is your schedule freeing up now where you will be doing more regular comic work? You know, we saw in the last couple of years, as you say, you've just been kind of coming in with the rest of the chapters of Mythos as, and I'm sure your part of it was done, but we were waiting for the art, and each time that came out was great. And I want to talk about your Captain America Theater of War specials that have been coming out, and there's still one to come. But how does your schedule look from a comic book writing standpoint?
Well, I had removed myself just a bit because it wasn't simply the concept of making the film that I'm working on. That is something that we've spent a lot of time doing. But the behind the scenes is always more complicated than people realize, you know. And so what I've actually been doing is spending the last year and a half to 2 years basically assembling my company, which is a IP management and you know, production company, and really doing all of the nuts and bolts of that. That includes, you know, learning about such things as Securities and Exchange Commission regulations and
wow,
private placement memorandums. And as the president of the company and having a background in business anyway, I have to understand this stuff. I have to learn it and know it and consult with the CEO of the company and the council and make this company become real. There's no way to create such a large endeavor and to write comics full-time in that time. You have to really concentrate your efforts.
Understood.
I'm now back at Marvel. I'm back at Marvel with 3 new series that we are working on to announce over the course of the next couple of months. And you know, those series have basically been approved. So, you know, I won't make the announcement here because that's really something that I never do. I always want Marvel to control the flow of that information, but I can certainly say I can talk about it in some broad strokes. The bottom line is I'm back to Marvel, and I'm going to be working quite heavily on a lot of Marvel comics over the next year or two.
Terrific. Well, and also, Paul, I remember the last time we did do a long-form interview, we talked about being diverse as a writer and taking advantage of these new media and new entertainment platforms that, you know, you're learning a different way of writing for these things, but also from the business side and just tracking your career and going back to your years working with the Ninja Turtle guys, you know, Peter Laird and Kevin Eastman, and running the business for them and learning, you know, how to run a comic business. You've always had both hats, and I've always appreciated hearing your perspective as a creator that, you know, is building his own brand and building his own ideas, you know, from the ground up and everything, to hear the excitement and also the challenges that come with, you know, creating your own thing and you know, moving beyond working for the corporations and their properties and spinning your own ideas and, again, being the business guy as well to do that.
And there are so many strange, odd, esoteric little machinations of this business. So an assumption might easily be, well, he's going to strike out on his own. And of course, I'm striking out with my company. But having said that, I collaborate very carefully with Marvel on a bunch of stuff. You know, in a sense, I maintain very, very strong business relationships with people that I work closely with. So I don't suddenly abandon Marvel and say, well, I'm not a Marvel guy anymore. That's not even close to the truth. In fact, the way it's been is that there's been a general assumption, well, he's not really doing much with Marvel. Tom Brevoort, I think it was, he said to me the other day, wow, Paul, I actually didn't realize how many books you've done for us. Like, you've actually come out with quite a few, a couple that are being done at the moment. A Thor annual that I wrote for Warren Simons. There's the last issue of Captain America, Theater of War. We've done the Mythos, we've done some more Theaters of War, and of course I'm working on some new series. So Tom, it was who suddenly realized, wow, the assumption is that you haven't done much. You've done enough. In the meantime, I love the concept of always being able to write lots of comics for a couple of reasons. One is you can tell really cool stories in comics with an unlimited special effects budget.
Yep.
Number two is I feel that it kind of hones your chops as a writer. You're constantly put in a situation where you must solve a short story or a portion of a short story that month, no doubt. You don't have a choice not to hand in an issue of Spider-Man, because if you don't really want to hand it in, someone else will come along and do it, you know. It's
sure.
Going to be published with or without you. So I think it makes me a better writer to stay in comics and to continue. And I love doing comics. They're really cool things, you know.
Well, and you do it well, man, and then we're all glad to hear that you're coming back, and we're going to get more Paul Jenkins product, because as I say, it has been the times that we have had new product just kind of come through the transom, it almost seems, with the occasional Captain America, Theater of War, or Mythos, and I'm so glad Mythos finished, and you even said when it was coming out that it was going to be kind of loosely scheduled, when each issue is done, it's going to come out. But then at the end of the day, here's this beautiful collection of stories that can stand next to the original origin tales and have added depth to those stories without the necessity of a continuity reboot or you know, just like really putting any X's through any ideas that Stan and Jack or Steve Ditko came up with, you know, 40 years ago, and you're able to kind of, like I said, give it depth. Your Captain America Mythos story, for example. A wonderful look at Steve Rogers before, you know, getting the super soldier formula. I loved it. It was great.
Thank you very much in saying that. I mean, I'm obviously proud of Mythos. I'm really proud of Paolo and the art that he provided for us.
Absolutely.
It's amazing. He's a great storyteller and one of the few, count them on one hand, comic painters that can make a story move dynamically. I mean, his storytelling is brilliant. His sensibilities, his color, you know, his color sense, all of this stuff's really brilliant, right? He's a massive part of why that Mythos series worked. Having said that, what I felt was really interesting about Mythos was that we took, there was nothing broken about those original stories. Yes, they were dated. You read them and, you know, the first Spider-Man story has, you know, 20 panels a page or something. You know, we discussed that last time. But having said that, there was nothing wrong with them. They were all really interesting stories that set up characters where stories could be told with those characters for a very long time. And as time went by, there was more added to those Mythos. I remember reading as a kid the first time that Spider-Man lost in battle, and it was to Dr. Octopus. And you, as a kid, you felt that punch. You know, wow, man, did he lose? I can't believe my guy lost, right? It was very cool, and it's so much in the early days of this version, anyway, of superheroes, which was the one kind of pioneered through Stan, Jack, and Steve Ditko and all these guys. To come in with Mythos, I was very, very proud of the Captain America one that we did, because I just basically took the mythology. Here's this guy, he becomes a super soldier, and he has a desire to serve his country. And I added two small elements. Number one was, why did he so desire to serve his country? It really hadn't been put forward in the initial story, except to say that he witnessed the horrors of, you know, what was going on in Europe.
Yes.
In a movie theater, and felt very moved by them. So the premise that we put forward was that he so wanted to honor his father, who died when he was a young man. And his father had been one of the original Blue Spaders, that he desperately wanted to be in the Blue Spaders himself. He goes to join up along with the neighborhood bully.
Yeah.
And the neighborhood bully gets, you know, brought in, and Steve Rogers gets rejected. And when he becomes Captain America, that's not necessarily what he cares about. He knows it's his job. He knows how important he's become. But what truly gets his heart is that he is allowed to go cover as a member of the Blue Spaders and honor his father. And I think I've had so many positive responses from readers and who said that that story really moved them, because they could truly see that there was a good reason why this guy was a soldier and why he believed in the Brotherhood and, you know, his friends. And, of course, the other part of the story was that he follows the school bully, or the neighborhood bully, from the kid with a catapult to the idiot that kind of joins up with him for the wrong reasons, to a guy who wins, you know, Purple Heart and Medal of Honor in Brook or wherever it was, Sicily, I think, and to a guy that ends up being an old veteran in home next to Steve, and he comes back there every year to share his meal with the old guy. You can see that the truth of The Greatest Generation is that they were very, very ordinary people, and yet they became something extraordinary in a collective fashion, and that really struck a chord with the readers.
And it's that military code of honor that I think he respects so much that I think makes these Captain America Theater of War stories atypical as opposed to other war stories. And I'm glad to see that Marvel embraces that aspect of Captain America. We're seeing it now in Rebirth, Reborn, the story that Ed Brubaker and Brian Hitch are currently telling. I got to ask you so many questions about the current status quo, because, you know, you're back in the fold again, and just, you know, and obviously you've got to bow to the new status quo in a lot of these characters. But while we're on Captain America, would you like an opportunity to write a Bucky story of a modern day Bucky story now?
I don't need to. I'll be honest with you. I'd love to, because all characters are really, really valid and valuable.
Sure.
But I don't quite need to do Bucky, because I have a forum in which I've been able to do Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't really... It is... The things that I've wanted to explore are things about wartime. In our previous conversation, you'll recall, I talked about my own family's military history.
Yes.
Currently, my dad, who is getting a lot older and seems to be fretting about getting older, is continually sending me things from his house. He's sending me family heirlooms. So last time I think that we talked, I talked about a couple of bronze medallions that I keep in my house that are actually in my son's room, and they were commemorative plaques sent by the British government to the widows of my great-grandmothers, saying, you know, here's William Eldridge, my great-grandfather, you know, died in service of his country in Flanders, 1916, right?
Wow.
So they're massive, incredible family heirlooms.
Wow.
My dad just sent to me, he sent last year a watch, and it was a pocket watch that had been all over Palestine with my other great-grandfather on his side, who sadly died on a train 2 days before the end of the war. He also sent me about 3 weeks ago a locket that is a picture of my great-grandmother and my grandfather, who is age 3. Well, it's like looking at my wife and my little boy, who's 3. I mean,
wow.
To see that my great-grandfather had this locket, he took it with him everywhere. He died in service of his country. And, you know, those kind of things truly hit home and hit you in the gut. It therefore sets me up to be able to write very, very poignant stories of Captain America. And what has happened is I've had Tom Brevoort as a very close friend and editor for a number of years, because Tom really gets me, and he knows that I'm best doing short stories and single issues, and he's allowed me the forum to do it. So he called me up when I started on Cap and said, I'm lining you up for a 5-yard field goal. How would you like to do Cap in wartime? And we did a story about Cap and his friend who dies in battle, who's very timid and scared, and that is what makes him a hero, because he's so scared, and he's such a poor soldier that when push comes to shove and the moment comes, he saves his friend's lives, even though he's terrified. And that makes him an incredible hero. So many young men suffered this fate, you know, and I'm obviously from Great Britain, but I recognize the immense sacrifice made by American soldiers, because they didn't go to defend their shores. British soldiers did, in a sense. You know, France, you can see from the shores of Dover, you can see 22 miles away where Hitler's forces had come through and invaded. And, you know, they were going to come. They were going to come across the sea, and Great Britain was getting ready after Dunkirk to basically get pasted. Well, America sent her troops 3,000 miles away, not necessarily to save the lives of Americans, but to save the lives of foreign people.
Yes.
They sent them to foreign soils to save foreigners. That should never be forgotten by the world, because that was a massive sacrifice to make for, you know, and at the time, America's very isolationist. So having a tremendous respect, having the main character in Captain America Mythos, the other character, Doug, as my next-door neighbor, a gentleman who served on the USS St. Louis and showed me a photo of his best friend, Bobby Shaw, 2 days before the attack. And when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, Doug was at Pearl Harbor and his best friend Bobby was killed on the Arizona.
Wow.
So I live with this. And it enables me to create this massive love for Captain America and what he as a character represents. Because in my opinion, it's the honor that there can be amongst those that go into combat, because they're brothers. They're like rugby players. You know, I grew up playing rugby and soccer.
I understand.
Soccer players are selfish as hell. And rugby players, if you can get into this brutal physical battle, you all go down the pub, and I've always thought to myself, if I had to go to war, I hope I'm playing with rugby players. You know? So he's like the ultimate rugby player, and we get to do great stories I really cared about. One of them was about the true rules of combat and what set America apart from other countries, like Britain is apart and some of the Western countries are apart, because they refuse to be involved in the torture of other nationals. And obviously, extremely disappointing to have state-sanctioned torture in Iraq. You know, waterboarding was a crime that many Japanese were executed for after the Second World War. You can't
Yes.
turn around 50 years later and say, now we can waterboard. We changed our minds. You can, but no one will love you for it.
Exactly.
So much damage was done to this country where, you know, the veterans who fought in the Second War had given their lives to uphold values that were not that. And that was a terrible... The third one that we did, which comes out tomorrow at the time of this recording at least, is a story about one of my best friends, a mate called Brian Anderson, who is a triple amputee, who one of the only triple amputees to survive his injuries from Iraq. And Brian is an amazing guy, but what's so amazing about him is the first time I ever met him, he sat in his chair and told me that he felt very sorry for the gunner who was in his Humvee that did not get injured, because he thought that the economy was so bad that the gunner was going to go back to Baghdad, whereas Brian has a job as a wheelchair spokesman, so he felt very lucky.
Wow.
And the funny thing about it was, it wasn't a heroic speech that Brian gave. It was just being honest. He said, I think I've got opportunities now. People love me. People come and hug me. They know what happened to me. But no one kind of understands what happens to my buddy Kenny. You know, he's got a kid and a wife, and he works construction. He endured the same war that I did. He didn't get injured like I did, but I'm worried that he'll have to go back to be in the service. And the guy who was a navigator is actually still there in Iraq. That story shows up tomorrow. And one of the ways in which I'm so proud is that Tom Brevoort, who depends on how you know him, some people think he's a curmudgeon. There's this great legend that Tom is a curmudgeon within Marvel, but in fact he's like a big friendly teddy bear. But that was a little insider trading as well, because I'm not supposed to tell you that he's actually genuinely really nice.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't say it here. That wasn't me that said
it. No, don't worry.
But Tom, he's been my editor for years, and he will occasionally write back to me and say, Paul, I really liked this issue. I enjoyed it. And very rarely and occasionally he'll come back and say, this issue doesn't work. Let's fix it this way. And he's always right. So So we have a great mutual respect. And now every single one of those issues that's gone in, Tom has written back to me and said, Paul, this is tremendous. It's clear, it's obvious that you love this material. And I got to my last issue. I was actually working on three of them, and I got to, I called the editors and said, you've got to let me write this last one. It's like my love letter to Captain America. It's me trying to encapsulate everything that Captain America stands for, and the art is being done right now, and I'm so proud of that issue. And when you get proud of an issue, in my experience has always been, if I'm proud of an issue, it almost always seems to resonate with the fans.
Terrific, man. I mean, that's wonderful. And it's been these specials and the context of these specials that I think, as much as hardcore Steve Rogers fans miss Cap monthly, I kind of liked it, and I think we were all almost lulled into a feeling of, you know, maybe Bucky is going to take over, and if that's the case, there are plenty of Captain America wartime stories of many ages that still can be told, and that's why I think Theater of War has been so effective.
Yeah, I'm very proud of those books, and so I feel that what's happened to me in my career at Marvel over the last few years is the side effects from me taking a little time away to just do a few books and, you know, organize my production company and get everything worked out, is I was able to crystallize my thoughts on what kind of concepts and what kind of projects work best for me at Marvel and what don't. And it also allowed me to kind of have that discussion with Joe Quesada and Dan Buckley and Tom, so that now as I come back, the projects that are sitting there for me are things that I've wanted to do that are perfect for me, as opposed to trying to maybe insert myself on, say, a month title like the X-Men, mm-hmm. and find that my set of storytelling skills runs very much like the kind of one-issue and two-issue type stories, or a series of, say, five stories that has lots of vignettes and you know, individual kind of concepts that you can bring up. That's my strength in storytelling, certainly at least in comics. And I'm really grateful that, you know, everything that I've got now lined up at Marvel actually revolves around that. I can talk a little bit about it. Obviously, I think it's best for the guys at Marvel to be able to announce. But in general terms, the way I'm coming back to Marvel with a bit of a bang is I've got three series lined up. One of them is very much like Mythos and or Captain America. Dan Buckley had asked me to basically give some thought to coming to different places in the Marvel Universe, finding a way to tell individual single-issue stories. The way that Dan put it to me was that everybody loves Daredevil. It's really brilliantly written. It has been so well written, by Brian and Brew, that there's not necessarily a space to kind of come in and fix anything. There's nothing to be fixed. It's a really cool story. But as Dan Buckley put to me, you know, sometimes he wistfully wishes for the days when I would do those single-issue kind of Spider-Man stories about Spider-Man having a fight with a gang of mimes, because it was just funny. You know, why not, right?
Yes, or Typeface, and yes, some of the characters you've introduced.
Yeah, Typeface. Well, I'll never live that one down. But, you know, we had all kinds of silly stuff that was going on. I can remember scenes that no one, in those days, no one cared at Marvel. Like, they did care, of course, but they just, you know, no one was worried. And it wasn't a monthly kind of thing. So I can remember doing whole scenes about a piece of cheese that he kept in the fridge.
Absolutely.
He's singing Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, and just as he finishes it, his towel comes down, and he's completely, and his girlfriend walks in, you know. It's all that kind of stuff. It was a comedy that we were able to do in the form of single-issue little examinations. Every so often, we'd throw in a poignant one, and people really loved it. So Dan said, in his words, he said, you know, what I want to see is, I'd just love to see you write a story that was like Daredevil's good day. Like, just one good day. It's really dark right now. Could it just not be room for a comedy in which Daredevil actually succeeds one day and looks at the end of his day and goes, wow, I finally had a good day. The moment that Dan Buckley said this to me, it immediately sparked to me 55 stories in the Marvel Universe, not all comedies, but yeah, man, you know, that's my strength. I want to come in. Well, at the time, I was doing Captain America Theater of War, and that started off as just doing one issue of Cap, and I proposed the other three. Now they'll get the four issues that I did, they'll collect them as one kind of volume, and they'll be able to say, this is me saying what I needed to say with Captain America. Well, the idea is, I'll go to the X-Men, say what I need to say about them, and move on. I'll go to Daredevil, I'll go to Thor's universe, I'll go to these places, and be able to have these contained versions of what's actually happening there, say the things that I felt need to be said, and then move to another place. And I think that's just perfect for me. In talking with a couple of the editors, the senior editors there, they themselves said, wow, that would be perfect for us too. We'd love to have these volumes that kind of encapsulated our characters that we could always put there in front of people, while at the same time being able to continue our soap opera.
You know? Absolutely. Well, and also, you know, I can't help but notice that the new status quo with Spider-Man is very reminiscent for your time writing Spider-Man, and how I think very easily a lot of your ideas would fit into the current status quo. And if, you know, you could have a non-answer, but it seems to me it's too natural of a fit that, and certainly the way the books are scheduled now too, that there might be room for the occasional one-shot from you about Spider-Man, much as we've seen from Mark Waid and others. But again, it seems like they're traveling around the same territory that you are. I mean, you had Peter dating and living in this new environment in the apartment and his new neighbors, and, you know, that all kind of sparks the, you know, what's going on now. So, I mean, are you done with Spider-Man, or do you think there will probably be a time where you'll return to the character?
Well, I think there'll be a time I'll return to the character to do it the way that I'm suggesting now.
Okay.
And the way that you just said, which is that my way of doing it will be, because I've put those stories forward too. You know, like I said, I had a ton of stories. And it's not kind of coming in one month and being one single issue 22 pager in a sense and then moving on. In fact, the way I'm going to do it, which makes most sense, is, look, I've got a few things that I want to say about Thor's universe right now, and I've got these really cool ideas, I hope they're cool ideas, about things that are interesting about Thor, like what is it to be a god and how does that reflect the human condition? A concept that I'm very high on right now is the concept that Loki is always an outcast, and this is kind of typical of me. I always want to get them and give them a different perspective. And Loki's always the guy that messes up, and then, you know, someone kind of grabs him by the hair and says, you've been a bad boy, Loki. You know, we're going to excommunicate you from the gods. And I really have always wanted to write a story that was completely different about Loki, that showed Loki's value. And because otherwise he would not be a member of that pantheon of gods. He just would not be. There are reasons why lies can be useful. Your husband or wife is injured in a car crash, badly disfigured, and they say to you, I'm really worried about the way my face looks. Do you still love me and find me attractive? And of course you say, yes.
Yeah.
It's a lie that's told for a very, very good reason.
Yeah.
And Loki would be responsible for those good lies. And, it, you know, they can be defensed. So I want to tell that story. And once I get to that concept, now I choose the way the story's told, and I can come into those places to tell the story exactly the way I want to. And the editors seem very, very responsive to me doing that.
Very cool. Well,
yeah.
I want to ask you, that's great, man, and it is, you know, our conversations both on Word Balloon and a couple times, too, at conventions, it is that depth of characterization that always excites you, that comes through in conversation, and I know makes fans excited as well, and I think you are probably on the right track, and most people, as you say, when you feel like you've hit the right chord on a story, I think a lot of fans are going to agree. Marvel made an announcement in San Diego about Miracle Man. And honestly, I hope, and Marvel Man, and certainly his name is now Marvel Man again, and I know everything is still kind of in flux, I couldn't help but think that part of the plan will be to tell new stories, and I wonder if you have any desire to tackle Marvel Man as a character, because as you just said about Thor and being a god on Earth, that's kind of where Marvel Man was left when Alan Moore and Neil Gaiman last touched the character. And I, you know, you created the Century, and there are it seems, shades of Marvel Man in that character, but then still a very different character. And now that Marvel Man is Marvel property, I am as curious about you returning to your creation, the Century, but also if you have any interest in writing any Marvel Man stories.
Yeah, well, we go back to this crazy history that I've had in comics and in business, and one of is that I was at various times, you know, Alan Moore's editor and Neil's editor on Violent Cases of Tundra, and, you know, I actually was the original series editor on Big Numbers, as we've discussed, on,
yes,
on Hell. So I've been around a bit, and I've known these guys, and I've admired their work, and I've seen their scripts. I've had Alan Moore's massive scripts for these these projects in my hands and you know, kind of pass them on and read them. So I have this incredible affection for both of those guys, and clearly some of their amazing work was done on Miracle Man, which is now Marvel Man. It's back to where it should be, and I'm very, very happy about that. You're right, there are shades of Marvel Man in the century. I don't think that's anything I'm going to shy away from. It was something that you know, sometimes people would say, it's a Miracle Man ripoff, it's a Superman ripoff. And, you know, when I say it's a Superman ripoff, it's like, well, what was your first clue? The big S on his belt? I mean, come on, of course. Right? Yeah. It's not a ripoff.
No.
It's a take. What I thought was that if Marvel was going to have their version of Superman, which Miracle Man slash Marvel Man could have been, that he had to have the patented Stan Lee weakness. So here you get this guy, and he's a schizophrenic, and he's agoraphobic, and yet he's got the power of a million exploding suns, and you throw that into the Marvel mix, and it makes sense. Well, Miracle Man, when it was done by those guys, was always this kind of conflicted guy who, as I've somewhat written a little bit with Sentry, was wondering, you know, am I becoming a god? Maybe I am a god. What am I exactly? If I stand above mortal men, do I become a man that's enhanced, or do I become something else? And, of course, it was a great way to reflect the human condition again. You know, it was,
yes,
it was a way to kind of hold up a mirror to the way that we are with our gods and the way that we are just in our ordinary mundane lives. And it was elements of that kind of entered my writing in Sentry. You know, we had things where his wife was probably cheating on him with the gardener.
Yes, Linda, yeah.
She would say things to him like, would you not wear the Sentry suit tonight? Because I'm kind of in love with the Sentry, but I'm not really that attracted to Bob Reynolds. here you have this massive character who spans the galaxies, and he's trying to work out how does he feel about the fact that, you know, his life is complicated, or his wife may not love him. And I think that's where Miracle Man was totally, you know, set up to go in some ways. Had I written Miracle Man, I probably would have written many types of Sentry-like stories with Miracle Man. I happened to be able to do it with my character, the Sentry.
Yes. Well, and, okay, well, then with the current status quo of the Sentry, and his part in Dark Reign right now, and Brian is having a field day, having him as part of the Dark Avengers. And I think there have been some very interesting conversations between Norman Osborn and the Sentry, and Norman manipulating the void aspect of the Sentry's persona. You know, is that an area that you could see yourself getting back to as well?
My work with the Sentry revolves around the three-part story that I want to write. You know, the first one was the creation of the Sentry, mm-hmm, and his coming awake.
Yes.
And I felt it was very valid by itself. The second one was an interesting and quirky kind of story because it revolved around him coming to terms with what he may well be and finding out that, you know, in a sense, Robert Reynolds isn't actually the Sentry. Robert Reynolds is really more like the Void, and he became the Void in a very, very ordinary kind of way. He tried to get high, and he drank a really bad liquid. It was not. In some ways, it was satisfying and unsatisfying for readers. But I realized why, in some ways, it was unsatisfying, because I'm up at some point to do part three, which I always intended to do, and that is there's something that happens in the second Sentry series that's just a very key moment that was seeded there for a reason. And I can at least explain it, and then you can guess what I'm going to do with it, which is, at a certain point, the doctor asks him, my daughter is physically and mentally handicapped. Please, Sentry, she's only a girl. And Sentry says, look, I cannot do that. I cannot cure her, because the moment I cure your daughter, I become something else. And the Sentry's compassion gives in, and he cures the girl. And at that point, he can never take that back. Well, at that point, he has raised the question to himself, if I'm capable of miracles, what does that make me?
I understand.
And that's why I'm saying, you know, that Miracle and Marvel Man, these are elements of stories that I might have written with Miracle Man and Marvel Man. I feel like I'll probably naturally go into that with the Sentry and tell that third part, which is, not who am I anymore, but if I am this thing, what does that make me? having said that, I'd write different types of story with Marvel Man. You know?
I understand. And to be honest, I'm hoping that, and no decision, I haven't read any specific decision, but I hope Marvel Man is kept outside of the Marvel Universe and really in his own universe, because I made the comparison on another podcast that it's almost like taking your Evel Knievel doll and, you know, having it slam into a bunch of G.I. Joes, and it's fun for a kid from a toy box standpoint, but I really think that, again, depending on what the plan is for Marvel Man, I think it is much more interesting to see how humans contend with an unstoppable hero god as opposed to throwing Thor or the Avengers or the Eternals against Marvel Man. And I think the Century has taken root, and, you know, really, man, you with the Century and Brian K. Vaughan with the Hood, I'm really glad that these other creators have, you know, been able to build on what you guys started in your miniseries and make these characters very important players in the Marvel Universe. And the Century fits and has a very specific purpose to the Marvel Universe, which you know, laid out in that first miniseries. And I think, you know, and that makes sense. The Century makes sense in the Marvel Universe. I don't know. I don't think Marvel Man does, personally. And again, I'm willing to be proven wrong, and I'm not, you know, that's just a fan judgment, and I'm, you know, it's easy to be an armchair quarterback in that situation. But I one thing I want to see you go back to is I still think there are so many conversations between Bruce Banner and Bob Reynolds, or the Century and the Hulk even, and this new status quo for the Hulk and where the Century is today, because that always really intrigued me. And like you've said to me in our conversations, that, you know, the Century kind of treated the Hulk almost like a mentally handicapped, you know, friend or brother or family member that he kind of dismissed. Well, now what does he do with this, you know, Hulk that idolized him? And obviously we saw it to a degree in World War Hulk, but I just think there are so many areas of that relationship to be explored, and I look forward and hope that you'll have a chance to do that.
I've always liked the dynamic between those two characters, because the way I've written that has been like this little tragedy that gets a little bit of a resolution. The tragedy of Bruce Banner and his inability to relate to the normal man and his inability to keep his anger to himself and his really, really complex and difficult path through life is all simplified when he gets around the Century. So he can be like a sidekick and a loyal companion and be genuinely happy and say, "Golden Man," and he loves the dog, and he's like really friendly with the dog, and the dog's always like playing fetch with him with a tree and stuff like that. like, don't you have this kind of wish fulfillment sense that you wish the Hulk could just get a day off?
Yes.
Take me back to that thing that Dan Buckley said to me, which is, man, I could just, it would be really nice to see Daredevil have a day off and have a good day. And eat an ice cream, sit down, you know, and watch golf for like 3 hours and not have to worry about this stuff. We kind of want that for our heroes. It's like that's what the Hulk got with the Century, was a little bit of a gift. You know, I can be around this guy and my skin doesn't hurt, because he'd never been able to vocalize to everyone that what made him so angry was that his skin hurt when he was the Hulk, but when the Golden Man was around him, it didn't hurt anymore.
There's something, and you know, forgive me for generalizing, but this is something I've noticed, and I think a lot of others have as well. It seems like you British guys are able to look at these American characters and come up with the most interesting aspects of the big characters, and also find amazing strengths in forgotten characters as well. And it really is a pleasure to see how James Robinson approaches these things, Grant Morrison, yourself, Neil Gaiman, Alan Moore, Mark Miller, and it really is. And it's like, you know, God, we've been reading the same books as many years as you guys have as fans, and it is so refreshing to, you're like, well, it's right there. It was right there in Tales of Suspense 56, and it's something that you guys picked up on that none of us have before. But I think it's great.
I hear about it all the time, and over 20 years of doing this business now, I think I've worked out why it is that British guys, you know, are like that, and it's because of the way that we kind of receive entertainment in Great Britain. It's different now a little bit because of the proliferation of, like, large, you know, dish networks and stuff like that.
Yes.
But it's like we grew up with four channels, three, sometimes five, you know, like not very many channels of television. Our sports were not this bombastic attempt to, like, kind of set off fireworks, you know, in between innings, you know. We weren't, like, flooded with information. And one of the ways I've described it has always been the flood of information that comes to an American, it's just really unfortunate because if you grow up in this country, you don't know how to separate the wheat from the chaff. You don't know how to understand what's going on in the world. And because America's a massive country with 50 states, and I've traveled within the 50 states extensively. And, you know, Minnesota in February is very, very different from Miami in February.
Absolutely.
So as an American, you grow up and you go, man, I've got the whole world here. I've got all the entertainment I need. I've got into. But what happens is, by default, it kind of floods you with crazy information. A great example of this is I have a little boy, and now he's three.
Okay.
Little Torak is turned three, and he's sort of, you know, a little person now. And I don't let him watch very much American TV, not because there's anything against it, but because many years ago, American TV executives realized that if you cut every 5 seconds or less, you can basically desensitize a person's attention span. It's what creates attention deficit disorder in kids sometimes. But you can make them more receptive to advertising. Advertisers would say, not in a cruel way, but in a relatively benign way, well, I want to do that. That will help me make more money.
Sure.
So they started making television that basically cut every 5 seconds, and kids couldn't follow what their teacher was saying because their teacher didn't cut every 5 seconds. I found this out. I stopped my little boy from watching that, and he watches, seriously, these crazy old British shows that don't, like the stuff that I watched when I was a kid, like claymation stuff.
Sure.
And he mostly watches that kind of stuff. Like, we're very careful to regulate what he watches, only because I have a little bit of specific knowledge that helps me understand it. Well, that's the British thing. It's that we understand the world. We get world news. We understand the socioeconomics of Russia and that because we are taught to learn kind of thing. And over here, you are very much taught to follow John and Kate plus eight. You can't avoid it.
Yes.
I live in Georgia, and everything is NASCAR. NASCAR this, NASCAR that. When I first came here, I loathed it because I grew up watching Formula One.
Okay.
And now I've lived here for 8 or 9 years. I kind of like, hey, I wonder which next winning this week. You know, it's cool, right? I like it. And I sort of can end up in a conversation with my mates going, hey, look, you know, Jimmy Johnson did pretty well this week, right? Just kind of what you get.
Hilarious.
And, you know, that's what I've learned. Oh my god, you know, I should never say NASCAR because there was a rampaging cyber mob of crazy fans that got really annoyed with me about Captain America one time.
You know, I was going to ask about that. Yes, the Sally Floyd conversation at the end of Civil War, which honestly, Paul, I loved it because it was, again, it came from left field and it was this challenge to the character. Talk about that, please.
Okay. I'll talk about that. I'll try to put it, please listen to me. If you're out there and you're still annoyed about NASCAR and Sally Floyd, please listen to what I'm saying. Number one, she is a fictional character. The views expressed by this character are not necessarily the views of the management, okay? During the time of writing Civil War, we, the writers, including Mark Millar and myself especially, were kind of pegged by rampaging cyber mobs fans as being liberal or Democrat or Republican or whatever. And it clearly showed in our writing because we showed a clear bias. Now, my perspective on this is that if you talk in Georgia about CNN, which of course is centered here in Atlanta.
Yeah, absolutely.
They say, oh my God, what a left-wing, crazy left-wing kind of, you know, teasing. I have a friend from Spain who, when we brought up CNN the other day, he said, oh, my God, that's so right-wing, that TV station.
Hilarious.
It depends on your perspective.
Absolutely.
So Sally Floyd's, you know, not very well thought-out anger aimed at Captain America was clearly partly because I thought there were interesting things to say to Captain America to make him think, partly was a rant on her part. Remember, she is a very upset, left-wing, alcoholic lady.
Yes.
She doesn't necessarily think clearly. And that's not me distancing myself. I don't stand behind a political point or have something to say. The funniest thing about it was that as I read all these, you know, discussions, what my politics were, I happened to be extremely central. Like, I happened to be one of those very few rare people who kind of wants to hear what the Republicans have to say and wants to hear what the Democrats have to say and hopes that the best candidate might win and, you know, thinks that there's some merit in both schools of thought. And to have my politics kind of thrown out onto the internet 150 times and to have people just going crazy because she talks about how America is NASCAR and America is this and America is that. That's true. America is NASCAR. America's lots and lots of things. She rants about Captain America not necessarily understanding that. Me, I'm not so sure she's right about that. Maybe Cap does understand that, but I didn't answer the question. I raised the question.
Yes.
That's it. Done. Okay. Oh, man, I never get away from it. The funny thing is, those very same people that who, you know, clearly made a lot of noise about my loathing, my obvious loathing for Captain America, a few of them were able to find a way to comment on my version of Captain America as presented in Mythos, which shows this guy with a tremendous amount of love and affection, my own personal love and affection for my family and for, you know, veterans of foreign wars. And I've done it all the way through Cap Theater of War, and those guys still find ways to say that I obviously loathe Captain America. And you go, that's not, that can't be me, can it? It has to be that I got victimized by, you know, a rampaging cyber mob. I'm like the monster at the top of the hill that wrote crazy stuff, and they're coming after me with pitchforks, you know?
Absolutely, man. No, and that is, you have described the internet mob the same way I do. It is the villagers with torches. It is them storming the Frankenstein castle. And trust me, I think there are more people that understand where you were coming from, and again, appreciated the intellectual exercise that you were throwing out there without making any real judgment. Paul, you always show that in the panels that you do at conventions, whether it's a how-to writing or when you just discuss characters. And truly, this is one of the reasons why I'm always happy you come back, because we get into interesting conversations like this. So, no, that's
well,
good, man.
There's one other thing I wanted to say, which is about the concept of Iron Man. In Civil War, Iron Man is presented as being kind of a really bad guy. So the cyber mentality became, hey, Iron Man's mean. He's really bad. He messed up the world. He betrayed all of his friends. Well, guys, we wrote a very clear concept into that was intentionally ignored by the very same people that did not want it to be written. That Iron Man, in our Frontlines series, the reporters confront him and say, we found you out. We found out you've been funneling money, that you've made money off of this war. And what we found out is you funneled that money into a benefit program for heroes and their families. You are not what you have to be publicly, which is a villain. In fact, we applaud you. You're an incredible hero to this country. And even Sally Floyd says it to him.
Yes.
She says it in her drunken, angry kind of way, but she says, we applaud you and will not tell this story because we realize that it is for the benefit of these people. You know, what you've done is incredible. And they leave the room, and he literally flips his Iron Man mask across the room and begins to cry because it's true. That had to surely make Iron Man an incredible hero. It didn't, because no one wanted it to be true. They did not want that to have been read. They were much happier yelling and moaning about how bad of a guy Iron Man had become.
Well, but
and actually, you know, let them do it. I'm happy for it.
Well, that's fine. But I think, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's the great tragedy of Iron Man feeling like, look, I'm the one who has the solution to this problem. And as you say, too, doing the right thing with that solution. But and carrying the burden of having to seem like the bad guy as well. And again, that just plays to the depth of character, and again, another heroic burden, and a different heroic alcoholic burden as well, because there's also that aspect, because of the guy that Tony Stark is, the arrogance of, look, I know how to handle this problem, I will take the responsibility myself. And that's what made Civil War the interesting intellectual exercise, where these two guys who have been, you know, lifelong companions ever since they thawed Steve out of the ice, you know, and were always on the same page and really did have the same motivations and intent, but were doing it in different ways. And yeah, it's just, it's great because they were both heroes in that story. And we're seeing it now the way, you know, Matt is writing Iron Man as well in his Iron Man book. I think, you know, it's very cool. And again, I you know, this is the kind of writing that makes me in my 40s still care about these stories in a much more profound way than I did watching, you know, Iron Man and the Crimson Dynamo beat the hell out of each other 30 years ago. So
something cool to be said for watching them do that, for watching these massive fights.
Absolutely.
But I think that we found a way to, I mean, it's cool, right?
Well,
but
sure.
We found a way to do it in context now where we can tell a more personal story or even a larger story and have a point that can be made. And that's a little bit more sophisticated, I think, and it helps the overall kind of readership. I think that's where Marvel really made a commitment maybe 10 or 12 years ago once we went back to Marvel Knights, which is, let's get these characters and tell really cool stories with them.
Very cool, man. Well, let's talk about some of the other work you've been doing these days. You told me before we started rolling tape that you've been working on, you had an animation project that you just directed. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I just directed a project called, I thought the title was actually a little unfortunate. It's called Cyber Racers, but it's something that I kind of caught up with on with the producers, and I was not that fond of that title. I always thought it should be called something else, but it's called Cyber Racers, and the concept is, what's an amazing, interesting exercise for me is that it's specifically made for the concept of smartphones and new media, yeah? One of the things that people will see once it gets rolled out is that it's literally directed with the space and the camera angle to be on an iPhone or a smartphone. When you hold the thing away from your face, if you bring in a standard animation or YouTube, oftentimes you can't really see what's on there because it's not necessarily made for a smartphone and the screen isn't quite right. We made this as an interesting visual exercise to show that, in fact, you could specifically design things that work. So like I say, you hold it at arm's length away from your face and you can see and hear this movie the way it's intended on the delivery vehicle that it's intended for. So I thought that's kind of a cool thing to be able to do. And that project is completed through post-production. It's done through a company called Famous Frames, and Famous Frames will be putting it up on their website, and we here at my company, Bookstop, we'll be helping to kind of promote it and roll it out. But I think it's rolling out over the next few months. I don't think it's ready because they haven't got the specific mechanics of the website up yet, you know?
Very cool. You know, and I even from a podcasting standpoint, have been very interested in how the shift has moved from the laptop and desktop computers to the smartphones and how programming ideas are being geared for the smartphones. It doesn't surprise me that you're involved in that.
Yeah, another thing that I've been doing, I'm still working on video games. I have been working with TK on a game recently, actually a game that I wrote on a long time ago, one called Prototype, came out last month. Prototype, I did a lot of the original character creation. The thing that I brought to Prototype really was I created a lot of the characters for them. And then I created a thing for them called the Web of Intrigue, which is a mechanic that works within the story. It's kind of a way of telling the story and matching the story to the gameplay. And that's something that I think has been done to good effect in the game. After my initial sort of work on the game, I left the game and they had somebody else kind of write the story up. But I was there at the early kind of creation of the material. So, you know, I'm still active in games. And, of course, now I've got a lot of film and television stuff that's happening as well. So,
excellent. And I understand a new Darkness project is coming up as well?
Yeah, I got a Darkness Pit coming out, which is something that I think it's probably something that is best left to Dale Keown to explain.
Okay.
Because he started it so long ago. It's actually kind of like the Black Mariah comic industry. I think he might have started drawing the three-issue series in 1994, you know?
Okay.
Dale, I know because it's his character, has always been so super concerned with what this thing's going to be. And I think somewhat reluctant in his mind to really push forward with Pitt. But then he gave me the keys to the castle and said, Paul, write something. I wrote something, he really liked it, and he's doing beautiful work with it. So, you know, I mean, I think it's just taken so long just because Dale really cares so much about it. And, you know, We'll see it, I think, next month, I think it's listed for. And then I guess, you know, you guys can call me up and yell at me because, you know, someone mentions MySpace or NASCAR or something.
Okay. And the film and television stuff, are you going to wait until that is closer to release before you get into specifics on that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with getting into any specifics is that you fall into the trap of sort of announcing. These are big projects, but they take a long time. Everybody knows that I've been working on this film called Tattooer. That film, the big film, kind of goes very slowly. So really, you know, our hand is forced by the producers in that particular project. Having said that, I will, over the course of the next 3 or 4 months, have not one, not two, but 3 major projects and events in my life, like life-changing events, to announce. So watch this space, because there's actually plenty happening with me with all of this stuff. They really are massive, incredibly big projects that have come to fruition. And it's all down to, like I said, forming the structure of a company that can actually support them. If I would just done Tattooer, I would be seen as a one-shot kind of, I hope I get another job, I'm still a freelancer, even if it's as a director. In this case now, I have my own company. I can kind of push myself forward and fund some of my own projects and so on. You know?
Very cool. Sidekicks was always something fun you were doing with Chris Moreno. Are we going to see any more of that work?
Yeah, you will see some Sidekick. You will definitely see some Sidekick. That one actually puts a big smile on my face. Love Sidekick. Chris and I have actually been developing a new series as well, something called Portal City.
Okay.
We're really excited about it. It's Chris and I being wacky again, and
good.
It's basically Casablanca with video game characters.
Okay. All right.
Because, you know, it was never going to be simple, right? It had
sure.
to be something really strange, you know. So, yeah, Sidekick kind of sits out there. It's something that I want to do. I've actually got an Icon book in the works, something obviously we'll, again, wait for Marvel to really announce. But certainly there's something that we've agreed that we want to do. So if the Icon project gets rolling, then we'll announce that soon. And a couple of small press things, because as I've often said, you know, Marvel are very cool about me being able to complete the brand of my company. So we develop IP, and because we do that, and sometimes in the form of comics, they're very kind about allowing me to, you know, publish with a smaller press or something to get my IP actually realized. For example, Bertha Ramos and I have a project that is something that we've just loved so much over the last few years. We're actually publishing it and printing it with Soleil in France.
Cool.
But Soleil have a publishing agreement with Marvel. In fact, we release it in Europe and it goes out there, and then it comes in collected form here to Marvel, and we're able to release it in this country. So that's a really cool deal with Marvel, because, of course, they get to still be published by Marvel but begin the material in advance in Europe, you know.
Am I missing anything? I don't want to, you know, I don't want to wait 2 years if I miss something. So, have we covered everything you want to cover?
Certainly, because the problem is the next time we catch up, John, is going to be some big announcements.
Excellent.
Will already have been made. You guys out there will all have seen the new things that we're doing. And once that happens, I'm sure you'll also have seen some of the new Marvel work that I've got coming up, a couple more series that we didn't talk about. Nutshell version being that I did have a pretty big project internally at Marvel over the last year. We were unable to kind of cross-pollinate it with the other major titles, so it became its own thing. So we're doing that. And we have another series that kind of comes out of the Captain America Theater of War. Tom Brevoort obviously was right. He did line me up for a 5-yard field goal. So he lined me up for another 5-yard field goal, and I want to do that.
That's great, man.
That's my new stuff.
Well, that's...
I'll give you one last announcement.
By all means.
I just realized something that comic fans have been asking me about over the last couple of years, something that they missed very greatly. I stopped writing the Flogging a Dead Horse column about 2 years ago.
Ask you about that. Okay.
And what I can tell you is that plans are afoot for that column to reemerge and rear its ugly head. The life of Jenkins and My Perfect Wife and baby Torak is about to come full circle. And little Torak is three right now, so, you know, to kind of show that. We're going to revisit the concept of the five craziest women I ever dated, my 10 most stupid sporting injuries, and other fan favorites. So watch out, because we'll be pushing that one back into the forefront soon.
I'm very happy that's coming back, and look forward to seeing new episodes of Flogging a Dead Horse. I know a lot of us have missed it, and we look forward to it coming back.
All right, well, it's great talking to you, and watch the skies, everybody, because I'm back with a vengeance.
Great catching up with Paul Jenkins. Make sure you check out Planet Scars Aftermath and Son of Hulk. The first issue came out last week. Plus, Paul has one more issue of Captain America Theater of War coming out sometime this month. And it sounds like a lot more new Marvel books are going to be coming out from Paul in the near future. So, as he said, keep your eyes on this space. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you that Word Balloon is all over the internet. Come to our website, wordballoon.com. You'll find an archive with many interviews with comic book creators and writers. You can also follow us via iTunes. You can subscribe to our RSS feed. Check us out at newsarama.com. And follow me on Twitter, John Wordballoon, or at Facebook. If you have any questions or comments about the show, make sure you visit the Wordballoon message board, which you'll find at a link at wordballoon.com. Or, of course, you can email me, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.